Welcome, good morning to all that are here. It's good to see you folks. We spent last Sunday in Tyler. We had a San Angelo blizzard, which means a quarter of an inch of ice and snow on the ground. But most of the folks there made it out, and they actually had they have three or four families there from Mexico, and one of them spoke in Spanish. He did an excellent job. Of course, I understood 99% of what he said. So it made a difference for me. Karen couldn't understand it at all, and the translator was not clear, and so there you go. But he did a great job, and I've toyed with, I'll visit with y'all. I don't know if we want to do that or not. It makes, you know, the sermon twice as long because you say it in Spanish, then you got to say it in English. But he was dynamite. He was like Brother Juanito up in Odessa, and he had some really, really good things to say. That said, we enjoyed the trip and made it back safely, obviously. It's good to see all of you that we didn't get to see last week. And I hear some of y'all couldn't make it to services, so we're good to see everyone. I have the speaker schedule for this year in the back. I posted it on the bulletin board as well. Our first meeting will be with Brother Cody Stone, February 17 and 18, Saturday and Sunday. And then we have pretty much the regular crew. We have Brother Carl Johnson for our summer meeting in June this year. We've got Brother Jerry Dickinson lined up the next year after that, Brother Nathan Batty, and then Brother Glenn Ballard. So we've got some folks agreed to come and speak for us and help us out. We've come to Acts, the 12th chapter in our study this morning. But before we get there, let's see, I'm not going to turn the lights on. So before we get there, I think you can see that. Fascinating article in Acts and Facts magazine. This is the blue-spotted stingray. It's beautiful in itself. I didn't know that stingray had blue spots, but this particular variety does. And the article I've condensed, but it started out, an example of science fiction is the evolutionist's efforts to explain the fossils found at Wyoming's Fossil Butte National Monument, an astonishing fossil graveyard administered by the National Park Service. The unusual mix of fossils doesn't make sense if you assume evolutionary stories. Rather, the physical evidence provides many samples and details for paleontologists to speculate and quarrel about. The obvious in-your-face issue for any paleontologist that is expressing evolution or evolutionary paleontologist is this. These fossils memorialize clearly reconcilable animals. So you see this guy. We're going to see a fossil of this stingray in just a second. But they shouldn't be recognizable as anything. Animals with fragile body parts like damselflies, crickets, and wolf spiders are so delicate that when they die in the wild, they disintegrate or are eaten quickly and soon disappear. And it's amazing that certain creatures that live in the ocean only, like stingrays, were buried in Wyoming so quickly and so tightly that their body shapes did not disintegrate before fossilization. And here is an actual fossil that's found there in that Wyoming preserve. The unusual mix of fossilized graveyard remains at this monument consists of more oceanic animals than just stingrays. And it is jumbled together with terrestrial animals such as insects, various spiders, birds, finfish, and shellfish, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, gastropods, that is snails, mussels, clams, and more. All of these animals are here in this unique location and have all been fossilized, preserving them perfectly. They weren't eaten, they didn't decay. Something instantaneously happened. Well, aside from this great preservation, how can so many oceanic animals like stingrays get buried with land animals inside the Rocky Mountains in Wyoming instead of along some ocean beach? It's an oceanic stingray. It shouldn't be there. Pacific Ocean, Atlantic Ocean, and this preserve is right there in Wyoming. Now, Wyoming is not known for oceanfront property, right? So how did an ocean stingray find itself and there was a lot of them, find itself in this preserve. Only the worldwide Genesis flood makes sense of this fossil graveyard. If there had been no global flood, these animal fossils shouldn't exist at all, much less be recognizable animals. The fossils of Wyoming's Fossil Butte National Monument now comprise a paleontological memorial to the fossil-forming Genesis flood. How about that? So only the flood, quickly submerging and then covering this graveyard with cementitious-type sediment, can explain what happened. Why you have this amazing mix of fossils up here in Wyoming. So next time, I don't know that Karen and I will ever get back that way. We always go and visit the Grand Tetons. They're up in here somewhere. And I'm going to go to this monument. That makes more sense to me than looking at those mountains. But interesting. This guy is up in the hills of Wyoming. Who knew? All right. We have for our consideration this morning Acts the 12th chapter. I've entitled this lesson, You Cannot Fight God. This is it's really a character study. And usually we choose people that are good and honest and, you know, we want to make an example of, we want to follow as our character studies. Well, Acts the 12th chapter deals with a character you do not want to emulate. You don't want to choose. You do not want a poster of him on your wall, okay? So You Cannot Fight God is the subject this morning. God has made a universe that reflects His nature and is built on His law, and a man is a fool to live against the grain of that nature and that law. And I don't use the word fool lightly here. You're completely devoid of wisdom if you choose to live against God's law. For a man to live in war against his Creator is just folly. For a man to live in violation of all the laws of a universe infinitely more vast than man just doesn't make sense. And yet many men live their whole life fighting God, God's law, God's plans. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Solomon stated how futile this was in Proverbs 21 and verse 30. He said, "There is no wisdom, nor understanding, nor counsel against the Lord." And what he meant by that was anyone who goes against God is not wise. There's no wisdom in that course of action. Nothing, no one can stand against God, and yet men foolishly slam their own wills against the will of God like shattering eggs against granite. For example, you can go back to the very beginning and you find that God had a standard, and Eve decided to fight it, and Adam decided to join the fight, and as a result, the Bible says all of us are cursed. God had a standard for sacrifice. Abel obeyed it, Cain fought it, and he wound up cursed. God had a standard for morality. Noah kept it, and the rest of the world fought it, and they drowned. Now I'm going to bring you right up to the present time. And there's nothing personal here. I'm sure that some of you might have been big fans of a certain rock band in the 1960s. Probably the most famous of the rock bands in the 1960s. So this is not personal. But John Lennon, in March of 1966, in an interview, he said that they, the Beatles, were more popular than Jesus Christ. I remember as a young boy of 11 years old, I remember my father finding out about this. He was not a fan of the Beatles to start with, you can imagine. And this really bothered him. I just remember how upset he was that a rock star would compare themselves to Jesus Christ. He went on to say that their music would outlive Christianity, that Christianity was decaying, and that it was about to vanish, and that their rock music would outlive Christianity. Well, surely you know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. You cannot fight against God. I just offer that as an example that some of us in this room, we can understand, we can relate to. For our introduction this morning, our reading will come from verses 21 and 22 of Acts 12. So on a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. And the people kept shouting, "The voice of a God and not of a man." We'll leave that as a break point. We'll approach, we'll take this time to approach God in a word of prayer. Won't you humble yourselves? Well, we'll just say right up front, this might be the most mixed up family that you'll ever meet. One of the most famous families of kings that ever fought God were known as the Herods. In the 12th chapter of Acts, we are introduced to the main character, King Agrippa I. And in verse 1, "Now about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church." About that, it was about the time of the great famine that struck Israel and Jerusalem. And Herod stretched forth his hands to vex, and that means to injure, to harass certain of the church. In plain words, he decided to persecute the church. Now, we've got Herod that killed all the baby boys around the time of Jesus. We've got Herod. We've got Herod that Paul, Agrippa that Paul talked to. And until this study, I had no idea. So if you go back and you think of Pharaoh, there were a lot of pharaohs. That was just the ruler of Egypt. And if you go back to Russia, there were a lot of czars, and that means Caesar, and there were a lot of those. Go back to the Roman Empire, there were a lot of Caesars. So there, in the Jewish history of this time period, there's a lot of Herods. It's all one big, mixed up family. So let's take a few minutes and just look at just how bad this really was. So I found this really neat chart. I wish I could tell you I created this. I did not. I had no idea. But I'm going to go through it here because you really need to know who you're dealing with in this story. It makes all the difference in the world. So we've got a gentleman, a person named Herod the Great. He was governor of, Galilee for about 10 years before the birth of Christ. And he was king of the Jews from 37 BC until the year 4 AD, 4 years after Jesus was born. He's the guy that when he got the news about baby Jesus, he tried to kill the infant Jesus by slaughter of the innocents at Bethlehem. He's the founder of this dynasty. He's the first one of the dynasty. Then he had 10 wives. There's 6 over here, Adorus, Phallus, Elpis, Phaedra, and 2 that we don't even know. And then there's 4 of his wives that we do know, and they're listed there in red. All right, Herod Philip was one of his sons. And Herod Philip was the uncle and first wife of Herodias. See that line right there? She's married to Herod Philip. Now, I'm going to use Aaron this morning because she's in the perfect position to explain so that we can understand what's going on here. She married Dwayne, her uncle. Okay? That's what that means. Herodias, sweetheart that she is, and she's the daughter of one of Herod the Great's sons. So she's just intermarrying the family. She leaves Herod Philip, and she marries Herod Antipas, another one of her uncles. So she married Wesley. She left Darren and married Wesley. Herodias. She's a work of art. All right. John the Baptist rebuked Herod Antipas for this marriage to his niece. It's not right. She was married to her uncle. She left him and she married you. This is not right. Salome, the daughter of Herodias and Herod Philip, danced for Herod Antipas. And at Herodias' direction, she requested the beheading of John the Baptist. She later married Salome. This is why I picked her. Salome, this sweetheart of a young lady here who asked that John the Baptist be beheaded, she married her great-uncle, Philip the Tetrarch. So, Aaron, if she was Salome, she married Dwayne's brother. This is just nuts. normal family, right? This was the dynasty that ruled all of this land at this time. All right, Herod Antipas was the Tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. He ruled until the year 39 A.D. He was Herodias' uncle and second husband, and he executed John the Baptist at Salome's request. He later participated and held part of Jesus' trial. So this is the Herod that Jesus appeared before at his trial, before his crucifixion. Herod Archelaus ruled until the year 6 A.D. and was replaced by a series of Roman consulates or Roman governors, including Pontius Pilate. So Pilate replaced this gentleman, this son of Herod the Great. Philip the Tetrarch, he ruled over the northern territories of Israel. He ruled until the year 34 A.D., and he later married his grandniece Salome. All right, King Herod Agrippa is the son of this unknown son here of Herod the Great. So this is Herod the Great's grandson. King Herod Agrippa I is the gentleman we're going to talk about this morning. He executed James, the son of Zebedee, and imprisoned Peter. All right, it gets even better. Berenice is the daughter of King Agrippa I. She was twice widowed. She left her third husband to be with her brother, King Herod Agrippa II, the son of the guy we're talking about this morning. And this is the guy that appeared at Paul's trial with Festus. This is the Herod, the King Agrippa, that Paul addresses in his talk. We're not done. King Agrippa II was appointed by Festus to hear Paul's defense. Antonius Felix, the guy of Acts, the 24th chapter, Roman procurator of Judea, Paul's first judge, left him in prison for 2 years until a new procurator, Porcius Festus, became the second judge and Paul appealed to Caesar. So that's the Felix. Drusilla, who is the daughter of King Agrippa I, the guy of our story this morning, the sister of Berenice, marries Felix after she left her first husband. This is the family we're dealing with here. These were the folks in charge. And if you say that, well, this sure sounds like corruption, you would be absolutely right. So Herod was the name of this family of rulers here. Herod the Great, and all of these guys down in here, all of these folks were known as Herod. So when the Bible, the New Testament, refers to Herod, you kind of have to know which of these Herods they're talking about. Herod the Great started ruling about 41 B.C. and ruled till the time of the birth of Christ. He's the one that put out the decree that all of the male children be slaughtered to try and get rid of a would-be threat to his throne. He married 10 times. He had a lot of children. And his children in and out of the New Testament scriptures dominate the scene. Now, Herod the Great was a Jew. And that's important. Herod the Great's grandson, Herod Agrippa I, also wanted to curry the favor of the Jews. And he only did what was expedient to get himself promoted. He was wily, cunning, and devoid of any sense of morality. So he begins a persecution here in Acts the 12th chapter, and he's truly a despicable character. We see him beginning something at the start of Acts chapter 12. We see him ending everything at the end of chapter 12. He is the picture of the fool who fights against God. So if you get nothing else out of the message this morning, remember this gentleman, King Herod Agrippa I, and the story that we will discuss this morning. Now, we come to chapter 12, which is, it's worth noting. This is the last part of the first section of the book of Acts. This is, there's been one man who's dominated the book of Acts up until this point, and that's our beloved apostle Peter. This is the last chapter of Peter's ministry. He has a brief appearance in chapter 15, but after this chapter in the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul dominates the narrative. So I just want to mention that as just kind of help us look at things. Peter's the first part that we've been studying, and now as we continue our study in Acts, we'll be talking about the Apostle Paul. So, as we read in verse 1, we find King Herod Agrippa beginning his plot. In verse 2, he starts to persecute the church. The first thing he did is he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And you can imagine what a sad experience that was for the early church. James was one of the three inner disciples, Peter, James, and John. He was the son of Zebedee, the brother of John the apostle. Now, this Herod Agrippa I, Herod was not anti-church or anti-Christian in the purest sense, like some of the Roman rulers would be, the Caesars and emperors would be afterwards. He's just pro-Herod. And so this is a political thing. It's a political game, if you will, with Herod. He sees it as an opportunity. He's your typical Roman playboy adventurer. Between his wily nature and his good contacts, he was moving up the ladder of society. And he knew that if he could pull off a big deal in Judea and do well, he'd really be in for a promotion. And he knew the best way to do well in Judea was to succumb to the Jews. And the Jews, more than anything else, were antagonized by the Christians, this new way. And so he started on a campaign to slaughter the Christians. Verse 3. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, that is, to kill James, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. Of course, Peter was the one the Jews would hate the most because he was the most vocal of this new band of apostles and disciples. He was out shouting the gospel on every corner in town. They tried to put him in jail, but he was like the proverbial bouncing ball. They no sooner got the door locked, and he was out preaching again. Angels and so forth were always letting him out. And I like the way one commentator said it. He'd been in jail twice before, and every time he got near the Sanhedrin, they had to listen to his sermon, so they were reluctant to even arrest the guy. I just really like the way some people can see through the fog. The Sanhedrin, the group of the elders, they didn't want Peter preaching to him again. Just leave the guy alone. But when Herod saw that it was really, really pleasing to the Jews to kill James, one of the Christians, he figured, I'll kill the leader, and they'll really love me, and I'll secure my popularity forever. So, it was Passover time. And Herod laid this thing out, oh, so beautifully. Passover meant everybody was in town, in Jerusalem, right? From all over the known world, Jews would come and gather in Jerusalem. Everybody will be here. And he thought, I'll put on this deal. I'll display this before the whole Jewish world, and they're going to love me. But he was smart, and he wanted maximum coverage for what he was about to do. And he knew all these Jews would be very busy during the Passover itself with their ceremonies and their rites and rituals. So he didn't want to try and run parallel to the Passover. He says, I'll wait. I'll wait till it's over. Everybody's still hanging around, and I'll move in, and the big moment will be mine. So verse 4. So when he had him arrested, that is Peter, he put him in prison and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. He arrested Peter. Again, that must have been a terrible trauma for the early church, as the soldiers came in and arrested Peter and hauled him off. Now, these squads of soldiers, there's four squads of soldiers. These squads of soldiers were known as a quaternion, or four soldiers. Four times four is 16. So 16 guards were assigned to watch Peter. The Romans had divided the watches into four watches of 3 hours each. That's 12 hours. So your job was to watch, be with the prisoner for 3 hours, and then you were off until 12 hours later, and you got to be with him for another 3 hours. Two of them were chained to Peter. Two of them were outside the cell. This was Herod's idea of maximum security. They were going to wait until the Passover was over, and then Herod was really going to pull this big thing off. Peter was a key man. He was powerful. He was dynamic. He was a leader, a strong leader of the church. And if they could just take care of the leader, they could probably decimate the ranks of the Christians. So for the third time, Peter was put in prison. And you know something? Herod is just another in a long line of self-deceived, power-hungry men who think you can fight God. Jeremiah 21 and verse 5, we find this quote. God says, I myself will fight against you with an outstretched hand, with a strong arm, even in anger and in fury and in great wrath. Really? Want to go up against that? The hand that stretched out the heavens? Really? Want to take him on? Well, this chapter, this story, gives us three really good reasons why a man is a fool to fight God. Number one, God's power cannot be contested. You can pit all your strength against the power of God, and you aren't even beginning to touch His nature, His person, or alter His plans. His power cannot be contested. And here's good old Herod. He says, I'll take care of these Christians. I'll put them in my jail. He gave it everything he had. Strong walls, big bars, iron gates, soldiers, chains, prison cell, authority, everything. Put Peter in there. Maximum security. But Herod, trying to capture Peter, was like trying to catch the rainbow in a net. It couldn't be done. Verse 5. Peter was therefore kept in prison, but constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. How long was he going to be kept there in prison? Till the Passover was over. The church, even though this would have been tough on them, it says, but prayer was made without ceasing by the church unto God for him. The constant prayer was offered to God. This word constant doesn't so much mean as not ceasing or not stopping as much as it means intensely. The church gave their total effort. They were totally lost in praying for Peter. They devoted themselves to praying for Peter. Verse 6. Old Herod, he thinks he's got everything secure. Here's this little band of helpless, powerless people. They're praying. They don't have any government power. They can't do anything. They don't have the key to the jail. All they can do is gather on their knees and pray. Verse 6. And when Herod was about to bring him out, that night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guards before the door were keeping the prison. See, Herod was getting ready to execute Peter in the morning. Now, Peter, how does this happen? Peter was on the jail floor. We're not talking concrete. We're talking rough. Dirt. Peter was on the jail floor with these people chained to him. And I'll tell you, I think it'd be tough to sleep the night before your execution. I don't know how you fall asleep. But he's asleep. Not only is he asleep, he's sound asleep. He's out. So verse 7. Now behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison. And he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, arise quickly. And his chains fell off his hands. Peter was so far gone, he was so asleep, that this angelic light that appeared in the prison did not awaken him. The Bible says this, the angel smote Peter on the side. He struck him on the side. He whacked him a good one. And meanwhile, the two guards that were chained to him, they've been given some sort of divine anesthetic. They're out. The chains are off. He's up. He's standing there. He doesn't know what's going on. Bleary, groggy, still asleep. He's standing there in his sleep. God is freeing him. And in verse 8, then the angel said to him, gird yourself and tie on your sandals. And so he did. And he said to him, put on your garment and follow him. Verse 9. So Peter went out and followed the angel and did not know that what was done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. Peter thinks he's still dreaming. Bless his heart. Verse 10. And when they were past the first and second guard posts, they came to the iron gate that leads to the city, which opened to them of its own accord. And they went out, went down one street, and immediately the angel departed from them. The angel had done his job. Well, Peter finally wakes up. And he comes to his senses, and he seeks out the house where the believers were praying. So I'm going to skip down to verse 17 in the interest of time. Luke tells us that Peter departed and went to another place. I never picked up on this before. Peter got out of town. Peter went into hiding. And Luke doesn't tell us where he went. And one commentator said that was by design, because when this was read, Luke didn't want the authorities going and finding Peter and arresting him. So Luke doesn't tell us where he went. He went to another place. He got out of town. Verse 18. Herod is angry. Then as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers about what had become of Peter. Can you imagine? Two guards woke up, and there the chains are, and Peter's gone, and the gates are open, and everybody knows that if a soldier loses a prisoner, he pays with his life. Well, somebody had to pay, and Herod was mad. His whole popularity contest had just gone down the drain. And so verse 19, but when Herod had searched for him and not found him, he examined the guards and commanded that they be put to death. Now here, Herod learned you can't fight God. Why? Because God's power cannot be contested. Herod had amassed all the power that he had, and it was nothing. It was a drip against the ocean of God's power. So Herod tucked his tail between his legs, and he crawled off in a huff to Caesarea, verse 19, and he went down from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there. He was really upset. His little plan had gone down the drain. As he went to soak up a little sun and some self-pity in Caesarea down by the sea. Well, King Herod Agrippa I learned a lesson, but he didn't learn it very well. He did learn that you can't fight God because his power can't be contested, but you know, he thought he'd try again. And then he found out, he learned that God's punishment cannot be avoided. So reason number two, not to fight against God. God's punishment cannot be avoided. His power can't be contested. His punishment cannot be avoided. Verse 20. Now Herod had been very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. I get the feeling from reading this short passage that Herod lived much of his life angry. The guy stayed mad. So here's Tyre and Sidon, two free cities north of Caesarea. Caesarea is right on the Mediterranean Sea to the west of Jerusalem. Tyre and Sidon were very good ports for the Jews to use for their import and their export business. So this actually was a pretty neat map I just stumbled onto. Divisions of Herod's kingdom. Philip the Tetrarch ruled this part. Herod Antipas, the one that beheaded John the Baptist, he ruled here in Galilee and on the east side of Jordan. This was a Roman rule. This is what Pontius Pilate ruled over. Anyway, Caesarea is right here. Jerusalem is right here. So Herod Agrippa I makes his way back to Caesarea on the seaside. Tyre and Sidon are up there. Those are the ports that we're talking about. They were part of Syria. Now, Herod was upset. He was mad. Maybe he didn't like the duties or the tariffs that Tyre and Sidon were charging him for his movement of materials. So he got off all supplies, and they got to hurt. When Tyre and Sidon couldn't get the food they needed and the supplies they needed from Galilee and Israel, they were in trouble. So they knew they needed to make a treaty with Herod. They needed to come before him and make a treaty. So continuing with verse 20. But Tyre and Sidon came to him with one accord, having made Blastus, the king's personal aide, their friend. They asked for peace, because their country was supplied with food from King Herod Agrippa I's country. People from Tyre and Sidon decided to have a big ceremony. And they come down and they pay their homage to Herod. And they do whatever they needed to make peace to get their supplies back. Herod ate this up. Okay? Anybody bowing at his feet, he absolutely loved. And to see two powerful free cities bowing and scraping at his feet was so great, he decided to make a big occasion out of it. He decided that the whole world should know how super he was, how great he was, and watch these two nation cities at his feet, these two free cities. So he declared a great day, verse 21. So on the set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. Josephus, the historian, records this whole incident and adds some interesting detail. It was very likely under the pretense of a celebration for Claudius Caesar, Caesar had just returned safely from Britain. Hail Caesar for his great work in Britain. Let's throw a party. Let's have a big ceremony. Now, not only that, but some historians say that it was actually Caesar's birthday, the day that King Herod Agrippa calls this party. And so he thought, I'll put on a big shindig. Day one will be for Caesar, and day two will be for me. And so he used Caesar as a pretense to get all the officials there and had all the leaders arriving in Caesarea. And they met in the amphitheater that had been built by his grandfather, Herod the Great. And he comes out looking all splendid in his royal apparel. And Josephus said he had a silver robe on. Now, ladies, this was not a color silver robe. This was a robe made of real silver. Can you imagine how you'd sparkle and shine in the sunshine? And that's just what happened. He just looked resplendent in all of his glory, which is just what he wanted. Probably couldn't even look at it. The sun shining off of that silver would be so bright. This guy is really making a spectacle of himself. So verse 22, he gives his little speech, and the people kept shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Oh, they were playing it up. Herod loved every minute of his adulation. The Bible says God shares his glory with nobody. Verse 23, with no one. Then immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died. Now this word struck, that's the same word that we struck Peter on his side back in prison. So you can appreciate what a blow Peter got on the side to get him up. The angel of the Lord struck Herod. And when that angel touched Herod, God filled him with the worms of death. Josephus says the worms ate him inside for 5 days before he died. That's a sickening, debasing, terrible way to die. Just when a man thinks he's exalted himself to a place of glory, God crushes him to a place of humility. And I say, you cannot fight God because God's power cannot be contested. His punishment cannot be avoided. Do not fight God. This pompous fool was done in by worms. The third reason not to fight God is that God's purposes cannot be frustrated. You've known men who've tried to destroy God, they've tried to burn Bibles, they've tried to wreck the church, they've tried everything, and you know what? God's work just keeps going on. Look at verse 24. After all of this, but the word of God grew and multiplied. God's purposes cannot be frustrated. The church is going to grow. Herod tried to stop Christianity, but all he did was spread it. Persecution shot the church out all over the world. A man's a fool to fight God because his power can't be contested. His punishment cannot be avoided. I skipped a piece. For a man to think he's going to stop the purpose of God, I like what one commentator says, it's like taking a whisk broom down to the beach and telling somebody you're going to sweep back the tide. So, got a really funny story here to back that up. Our son Jonathan was always ambitious and industrious, and I can't remember, 7, 8, 9 years old, somewhere in that vicinity, maybe 6, I don't know. But he was a young whippersnapper. We went to the Pacific Ocean to visit Karen's parents, and we took all the kids down to the ocean. And Jonathan, Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer organized the troop of kids. John went up and down the beach and organized a group of young boys, and their mission was to pull the seaweed out of the ocean, to get it up where the water couldn't pull the seaweed back. And so they worked for a couple of hours before the boys gave up went back to their families. And there was this big mound of seaweed up on the beach. And John came back to us and said, "Look, Mom and Dad, look at all we've done." And about 5 minutes later, the ocean tide grabbed all that seaweed and just hauled it right back. So, you can't fight God's purpose. It's like trying to sweep the ocean with a whisk broom. It doesn't work. It cannot be done. God's purposes cannot be frustrated. So, Herod did all he could to stop Christianity, but all he did was spread it. Man is a fool to fight God because his power can't be contested. His punishment cannot be avoided. His purpose cannot be frustrated. Jesus said in Matthew 16 and 18, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It has a lot more meaning now than we've looked at this life of Herod. When God sets his purpose in motion, you cannot frustrate his purpose. Psalms 2, verses 2 and 4, a messianic prophecy. David wrote, the kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in heaven shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Cannot fight God. Isaiah said this, woe to him who strives with his maker. Isaiah 45 and verse 9. So in closing, I say to everyone here this morning, if you or if you know someone who's never come to Jesus Christ and obeyed the gospel plan of salvation, you're fighting God's only provision for your salvation and your forgiveness of sins. If you've never been baptized into Jesus Christ, you're fighting against his glory. And if you've not become a part of his church, part of his body, you're fighting against his purpose. Let's take that message to the world. You cannot find God. The God we serve. We never like to close without offering an invitation. If you're here, we can assist you in any way. Won't you come all together? We stand and sing.